agus fáilte isteach. This broadcast of WNYE's Irish Radio Hour, This Irish American Life, comes to you in association with Flannelly Promotions Limited. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan-Gray, and I am your host every Saturday morning on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, and broadcasting worldwide on www.irishradio.com. Our theme music is the opening set by The Gloaming, released by Brassland and Real World Records. Since 2014, I have been hosting this radio hour and am honoured to have the opportunity to bring to you interviews, talks and performances which speak to the Irish and Irish-American experience. As a historian trained in Ireland, Italy and the US, I have used interviews as a major component of my research, and I am always thrilled and honoured to use the medium of radio to share aspects of educational and ethnic interest. WNYE 91.5 FM is managed and operated by NYC Media, a part of the Mayor's Office of Media and Entertainment. Broadcasting throughout the metropolitan area from the 4 Times Square Tower in Midtown Manhattan, it serves the public 24/7 with its schedule of programming. The programming aims to inform, educate, and reflect the diversity of interests that make up New York City's population. I hope you'll enjoy this week's This Irish American Life. I am thrilled to introduce to this week's This Irish American Life author and scholar Jack Quinn. Jack has recently, it's pretty much hot off the presses, published a book called W.B. Yeats and the Language of Sculpture. It's published by Oxford University Press. It was published only, if I remember correctly, the publication date was in June. Jack is a British Academy postdoctoral fellow at the Department of English Literature at the University of Birmingham. Before joining the department, he was a Government of Ireland fellow at Trinity College Dublin, and he has published work on W.B. Yeats, Ezra Pound, T.S. Eliot, John Hewitt, and others. Welcome to This Irish American Life, Jack, and congratulations on, I believe, your first monograph. How does it feel to be at this stage in the process?
Hi, Miriam. Thank you so much for having me. Honestly, it's great to have the book out at long last. I think I've been waiting for it for so long that it's the novelty of having it in my own hands is a great feeling.
It's no small feat to publish your first monograph with such a renowned press, and you should take great pride in your achievements. And I'm so excited to have the opportunity to chat to you today about this wonderful topic, the fascinating personality of Yeats, and that intersectionality of literature and sculpture that you draw out in this wonderful contribution to the literature. Can you tell me a little bit about your journey for this book? I believe it possibly draws on your doctoral research, Jack, but can you tell us a little bit about the kind of intellectual journey that has culminated in W.B. Yeats and the Language of Sculpture?
It began from my PhD research, and this would have been a long gestation period for the production of this book that goes back to my PhD at the University of York. That's Old York rather than New York, where at the time, for some time, I wanted to write about W.B. Yeats, but I wasn't sure if I wanted to talk about just Yeats, and I was interested in a vision and the occult and theosophical beliefs of Yeats. At a time, I thought I might look at Yeats in conjunction with T.S. Eliot and think about modernist approaches to faith or belief. But I got caught up in the poems by Yeats about sculpture and poems that respond to specific statues as well. He has quite a few poems about political monuments in Dublin, the statue to Parnell, the statue to Daniel O'Connell, and Nelson's Pillar as well. But he also is interested in the sort of occult quality that he sees in abstract sculpture. And I started cataloguing so many of these different poems about statues and sculpture more broadly, and seeing it as quite separate from painting or the plastic arts in general. And I think what I really wanted to do was sort of look at these poems beyond the lens of just ekphrastic poetry or poems in response to the visual arts. And one of those things that happens as you develop from PhD into book was that I really began to realize how embedded this was across Yeats's life, that W.B. Yeats wasn't just responding through poetry to monuments or to pieces of sculpture, but that his whole life might be sort of mapped out with this relationship to the art form from art school in Dublin in the 1880s through to his responses to public monument commissions in Dublin. And then also into the modernist period, his interest in sometimes his critique of more abstract or modernist sculptural works. So it really became a project that wasn't just about poetry or close reading of texts, and became much more of a account of the life of Yeats, but also perhaps of the history of Ireland at the time and the importance of various monuments and the politics of those statues in public squares. So it sort of expanded and expanded through that.
What you do in that way is, it's a wonderful kind of, in terms of the best examples of literature and history, you're kind of just in a way tilting the lens a little bit to shine a light on his significance in this way. For the benefit of our listeners to This Irish American Life who are not as familiar with W.B. Yeats as maybe myself, or indeed certainly you as someone who has devoted a lot of time thinking about him and his impact on his life, can you contextualize him a little bit, Jack, and kind of lean into then where and how, you know, contextualize a little bit more, bringing sculpture in as this way through a lens or thread through which you would explore him in more detail?
Sure, absolutely. Yeats was born in 1865. The family for much of those early decades living in Dublin and in Howth, Yeats had a particular interest in art and going to art school. So I really begin there with W.B., his younger brother, Jack Yeats, who we know now as the famous painter, and his two sisters who developed the Kula Press and made extraordinary contributions to arts and crafts in Ireland. But the Yeats that we know as a poet sort of begins out as an art school kid, essentially. And what I begin the book by looking at is those years in Dublin from 1884 to 1886, where he attends two different art schools. And I try to sort of place that as a sort of beginning of this broadly chronological account of Yeats and his life that maybe puts more weight on the visual arts and art school training than maybe has been appreciated up until now. I think we sort of think of Yeats through those early long poems, the Wanderings of Oisin, the Island of Statues, and there again I think is a hint of the importance of sculpture. But at the same time, as he's writing some of those earliest poems, he's attending art school and perhaps has an interest in pursuing a very different artistic practice to the one that he's known for today as the most renowned poet of Ireland. So I sort of begin with those art school years that he recollects quite negatively quite often in autobiographies, the reveries over childhood and youth where he reflects on those early years in Dublin. He doesn't have much to praise in the art schools. He sort of recollects the boredom or the tedium of sketching various sculptures, sort of trying to copy from casts to perfect artistic skill, but often with an eye to industry. This interest in the schools preparing their students for artistic practice in the main through architecture and design. And Yeats becomes bored of that, or at least in his retrospective accounts, seems to remember this as a quite dull and deadening tuition. But at the same time, he also met some of the foremost sculptors or individuals that would become the foremost sculptors in Ireland in the coming decades. So Oliver Shepherd and John Hughes, who he meets in the Metropolitan School of Art and the Royal Hibernian Academy, both of which Yeats attends. And then also George Russell, who Yeats will go on to collaborate with in various ways at the outset of this Celtic revival and this interest in sort of reviving the myths of Ireland through literature and poetry, but perhaps also through sculptural and the visual arts, through this connection to the sculptors of the time.
If I remember correctly, Jack, the fact that, and you know, you said it out there quite nicely there a little bit earlier when you talk about WB, his sister Lily, Lolly, and then of course Jack Butler Yeats, who is renowned for his contribution to the visual arts, but they're a very kind of literary and artistic family and group of people. Can you tell us a little bit about the context in which that comes about for them in terms of their parents and their background?
Yeah, I think a lot of this comes back to John B. Yeats and his various successes and failures in illustration and portraiture. Around the time that Yeats is attending art school, John Yeats, the father, is teaching briefly in the Metropolitan School of Art. And the period in which W.B. Yeats is attending the Metropolitan School and then the Hibernian Academy overlaps with this period in which John Yeats is working in Dublin. And then the period in which W.B. Yeats moves to London is, of course, because his father is seeking work through the newspapers in London, and that move from Hoth to, I think it's Bedford Park, effectively ends W.B. Yeats's early art school training. It's when they go to London that Jack Yeats, the son, begins attending art school in London. But for each of them, it seems to be sort of following in the tracks, perhaps, of the father, that they attend art school and perhaps return to these connections in the visual arts in later years.
What do you know, or how important was it in terms of the dynamic of the siblings in terms of their pursuits? And in particular, I suppose, given your emphasis in this book on the visual arts and sculpture in particular, can you tell me a little bit, or is it relevant to ask you, Jack, about the relationship between Jack and W.B. Yeats?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. In terms of sculpture, I'm not so sure, but I think there is so much sort of overlap in those verbal visual collaborations between them, particularly in those early years. Jack Yeats, some of the earliest sketches that we have by him are illustrations of Yeats, of W.B. Yeats's poems, so his brother's poetry. And even into sort of that early burgeoning career as an illustrator for Jack Yeats, it coincides with the poetry being produced by WB. I'm thinking of the Irish Broadside magazines that have the two set side by side, I think in the 1990s or 1910s, and then revived again in the 1930s. I think it sort of bookends parts of W.B. Yeats's career where he's collaborating with his brother Jack. And in terms of the sisters as well, I think it comes down to book design itself and Yeats's publications through the Kula Press, through Elizabeth and Susan Yeats's work, where we see a clear convergence of their interests in these different art forms. And for Yeats, for W.B. Yeats, that's about creating a beautiful book through a private press, and the intention particularly for Elizabeth Yeats, is in developing that type of private press set up in Dublin using Irish material specifically for the bindings, and just producing beautiful works for the Celtic revival and for the emergence of new Irish writers.
The second chapter of the book engages with a theme that's the theme that you open up the book with so nicely in your introduction around public monuments. And you know, your introduction opens up lovely with a lovely anecdote about that sculpture, the bronze sculpture in St. Stephen's Green in the Memorial Garden, which people may be familiar with. Can you talk to me a little bit about, expand a little bit, if you don't mind, Jack, on the what you call the politics of public monuments in Dublin in the context of Yeats and sculpture?
Quite a few poems by Yeats respond to specific statues in Dublin. And I was living in Dublin for quite a bit of the writing of this book during my first postdoc, and I started to feel that every statue in Dublin had been written about, whether in fragments of letters or prose or in poetry by Yeats. He seems to sort of treat the urban geography of Dublin as something that requires commentary or critique at different times. You mentioned the Henry Moore sculpture in the Memorial Garden to W.B. Yeats, which is in Stephen's Green. And it's a beautiful work. It's one that is, of course, abstract and has nothing to do with the man Yeats in any sort of figurative tradition. But I think it's beautiful precisely because of that, that you can sort of come to the garden and see this beautiful sculptural work that isn't supposed to be Yeats himself in a public park that's full of traditional statues and monuments to great public statesmen of Ireland. And in the second chapter, I think more and more about that response to statuary and Yeats's unease sometimes with these statues that seem to celebrate or elevate public statesmen and that immortalize them, perhaps for a particular political cause or reason or agenda at the time. And yet Yeats is also occasionally complicit in this elevation or this hero worship of individual Irishmen in Dublin. So quite often he has this complicated relationship to public sculpture as a sort of separate category to the sculptural work that he was familiar with in art school, and perhaps also the abstract sculpture that he sees later on. Quite a lot of those statues that he responds to is an attempt by Yeats to complicate the legacies of individuals. So he talks about the Parnell Monument at the top of O'Connell Street that listeners might be familiar with. And in his poetry, he sort of connects the legacy of Parnell long after his death to the legacy of Hugh Lane, who's trying to build a new modern art gallery in Dublin at the time in the 1910s. And in the poem To a Shade, Yeats thinks about the frustrations that Parnell felt throughout his life and perhaps the Irish people turning against Parnell. Yeats sees as mirrored in the life and the difficulties that Hugh Lane had in establishing an art gallery in Dublin. And he uses that monument of Parnell, almost like the ghost of Parnell, as a way to keep this figure long dead present in Dublin. He also responds to Nelson's Pillar and the monument to O'Connell in a slightly more parodic poem in the 1920s, The Three Monuments, where his critique of the ban on divorce that's passing through the Irish Senate at the time, something that Yeats spoke out against as a senator. He also works this into the poem by pointing to these three statues on O'Connell Street that he says are monuments to their adultery, and he sort of uses this playfully to critique the elevation of these statesmen as examples of moral authority for individuals, but also sort of playfully suggests that these statues also exist as permanent records that undermine the government of the time and perhaps the rhetoric around them. So quite often, I think, with statues, he sees a sort of complicated idea of monumentality or immortality, where the individual can then have this far-extended afterlife, this sort of duration far beyond the human life, that allows it then to be contorted or appropriated by politicians of the day, but also by poets to use it to then respond to and imaginatively perhaps critique some of those agendas of the day.
What you observe there is all the more poignant or interesting to think about in the context of the youth of the Irish state as it was evolving. And I suppose maybe we could pick up a little bit. He's appointed almost actually 100 years ago. I think it's December 1922. He's appointed a senator in the Irish Free State government. All this is happening, and he's beyond coming of age, but he's moving in a very historical moment in terms of the evolution of Ireland and its relationship to the past and present. And as you mentioned there, the monumentality of the taking down of statues or the building of statues and what all that can mean at any moment in time, right? It's really interesting to think about him and to ponder other historical moments as well. But would you mind contextualizing a little for us, Jack, the WBA say that we pick up as appointed senator there in 1922? What are his preoccupations, or what is it significant in terms of his engagement with the visual arts and sculpture in particular? Or, you know, how does his award of the Nobel Prize in 1923, is that important to the narrative of your story?
It absolutely is. Yeats is a senator of the Free State from 1922, as you mentioned, up to 1928. And during this period, I think he's best known for his contribution to the debate on banning divorce in Ireland, which Yeats speaks out against. Also his positions on censorship at the time. But when you look at what he spends most of his time in the Senate, actively speaking out against or speaking in debates about, it's often about the arts, and particularly the visual arts, but also quite often about the preservation of public monuments or ancient monuments in Ireland. He has, perhaps understandably during the Civil War, a concern about ancient monuments being damaged or destroyed. He speaks out again and again about the Hugh Lane paintings and trying to regain them from the National Gallery in London. But he also quite often turns to statues, as I mentioned, sort of those monuments on O'Connell Street, which he mentions in the debate around divorce, and also about the Nelson's Pillar, the preservation of it, even though it's now sort of seen as an imperial monument in a newly independent Ireland. He speaks out about preserving it, even though he agrees with many of the senators at the time that it's a quite ugly looking monument. Again, he's sort of trying to defend these in a quite conservative vein as being important objects that record Ireland's history, however conflicted or difficult that might be to accommodate in the new Free State. One of his key roles as a senator in one of the chapters in my book is about specifically the Irish coinage, which Yeats becomes the chairman of the committee on soliciting and selecting designs for a new independent coinage for the Free State. And for Yeats, this is sort of a key moment in contributing to the visual and material culture of Ireland. He talks about coins as the silent ambassadors of national taste. And he takes very seriously the selection process to choose the coins. For listeners who haven't seen them before the Euro, there's decades in which Ireland had an animal coinage. It's quite a beautiful set of coins that were selected, and that initial set were selected by a committee chaired by Yeats. And whilst this isn't really public sculpture or monuments in the way we might understand them, the process in which these artists were selected and shortlisted goes back to Yeats's interest in the art of sculpture, I think. Many of these coin designers were monumental sculptors, and many of the ones that were shortlisted were primarily experts in monumental sculpture. But through this again, sort of Yeats and the committee for the Free State Coinage select eventually an English artist, Percy Metcalfe, to design the set, and despite sort of many disagreements with the government and frustrations over the designs, they eventually select this full set of animal coinage that I think has a lasting legacy as one of the most beautiful coins of the period, and ones also that distinguish themselves from those profiles of monarchs or statesmen that we see on most coinage at the time.
By chapter 4 of your book, Jack, you kind of get to, if I can put it crudely, the meat and potatoes of the book. As you outline it, you explore some of the counter-narratives in modernist approaches to literature and sculpture. And I note that Ezra Pound features quite heavily here, if I understand correctly, in terms of how sculptors, you name Jacob Epstein, Henry Gaudier, Brzezinski, and Konstantin Branuski as important figures here, and contextualize that with Yeats a little bit. Can you share with me, expand on that a little bit with me for the benefit of the listeners?
Yeah, absolutely. I sort of move from the specific Irish context of public statues and those debates around them, and indeed sort of the debates around the coinage in Ireland, to a broader and perhaps London-centric disagreement about sculpture, but one that also ties together international sculptors of the modernist period in the fourth chapter. For much of this, Yeats is familiar with and responding to the art criticism or the sculpture writing of Ezra Pound, and perhaps also the sculptor Henri Gaudier-Breschke. Pound is writing quite often in the Blast and then later in various periodicals in which he's defining vorticism, this sort of new abstract art that champions the sort of primitivism of the abstract work in painting and in sculpture. In sculpture in particular, it's about direct carving as well, this idea that you're not going to design through pointing methods model or work up a piece in plaster or clay and then translate it to bronze, translate it to marble or cast in bronze. For the vorticists, it's much more about taking the chisel directly to the piece of stone and working out the piece directly without the sort of modeling practice beforehand. And Yeats has a somewhat ambivalent relationship to these modernist or abstract artists, and quite often he's keen to get back to the monumental sculptors of the past and previous traditions, but he's also quite interested in some of the occult possibilities of these artists. And the Romanian sculptor Constantin Brancusi, who I talk about in the fourth chapter, is one that seems quite magnetic to Yeats' imagination around this time. Brancusi often works with these ovoid shapes, these sort of three-dimensional oval abstract works that are portraits or quite distorted figures of men and women at different times in his work. And Yeats is fascinated with this connection that the works have perhaps to crystal gazing, and sees them as almost spiritual emblems in a way that can be connected, in his view, to a much wider arc of the mystic possibilities of art. So it takes quite a different view to that of Ezra Pound. He sees these as the ideal forms of abstraction. For Pound, it's an almost platonic ideal of forms that are being set forward by Brancusi, and he also connects Brancusi in his own writing to Gaudier-Breschke and Jacob Epstein in a tradition that Pound is trying to create of principles of vorticism that live on in modernist sculptors. And for Yeats, it's a much more mystical and perhaps archaic connection that he's drawing between these sculptures, and this is around the time that Yeats is writing A Vision, this enormous work that tries to connect various civilizations and particularly the art forms of civilizations in this structure of gyres and this philosophy of history being interconnected and overlapping in different times. And suddenly somebody like Constantin Brancusi, working in abstract sculpture, is a figure that he can connect to different periods, and but also as a way in which he can see modernism as connecting to a lot of his spiritualist interests rather than simply being an aberration of abstraction that doesn't quite fit the mold.
Can I ask you, Jack, I'm correct in thinking that Jacob Epstein is the New York-born but English-based sculptor of that period, right, who he does the Christ or something as one of his famous pieces. Is that him?
Yes, yeah, that is.
And would he, for example, do you think that he and W.B. Yeats would have been kind of personally connected as well, Jack?
I'm not sure if there's much overlap with Epstein and Yeats. I know that Pound is particularly interested in the work of Epstein and connects him to that before it's set and writes about him, but I don't think there's a specific, except perhaps in A Vision where Yeats cataloguing all these modern artists. I don't think there's any greater collaboration that I picked up on between the two.
The fifth chapter of the book brings us into the prominence of sculpture in his late poems. And here actually is where an example of where we see you bring in poems about Maud Gonne and Isolde Gonne. And of course, you know, Maud Gonne is so associated with Yeats and all the themes and interactions and interconnections. Tell us a little bit about what you uncover in that final full chapter of the book.
I sort of start with these, what might be misleadingly described as love poems that Yeats writes, in which he imagines either himself or the sort of unnamed lover as sculptures. These are poems from the 1910s. One is The Living Beauty, which sort of has a Pygmalion myth type of component to it, in which it's a sculpture of a woman that does not turn to life, sort of reversing that myth of the Pygmalion sculpture that comes to life and falls in love with the sculptor. And the other one is Men Improve with the Years, in which Yeats describes himself as an old man who's almost a marble sculpture crumbling in a water fountain. And both are clearly quite frustrated poems that are playing off the erotics, I think, of sculpture and the possibility of sculpture as this desired object, but one that is cold, hard, and static. In each case, there's quite a sort of problematic vein to this as well, where it's probably Isolde Gonne that's being addressed by these poems, the daughter of Maud Gonne, who gets proposed to after multiple proposals that were turned down by Maud Gonne. But here's I think that sort of frustration is written in through sculpture as an analogy or as a metaphor. And throughout this fifth chapter, I'm thinking about and connecting the various metaphorical significances of sculpture and statuary for Yeats. I begin with those poems that move to A Bronze Head, in which Yeats responds to this marble, or at least a sort of plaster painted to look like marble sculpture of Maud Gonne in the Hugh Lane Gallery. There's one in which Yeats sees an agedness in Maud Gonne that seems to be exaggerated. He describes it as sort of mummy cloth and this almost Egyptian face looking from the sculpture. And he kind of reflects that back onto the Maud Gonne that he knows, but by the 1930s, thinking about aging and the sculpture itself materially degrading as well as perhaps a metaphor for life. And beyond that, just sort of thinking about the importance in this late stage in Yeats's life of sculpture as this paradigmatic object for how he thinks of loved ones, of passing civilizations, of societal collapse that we get in those Civil War poems. And the way in which it's clearly embedded in his thoughts across sort of politics and personal life.
That's really fascinating, Jack. One of the things I love about books like this is I love appendices in general, and you in this wonderful book publish a transcription of an unpublished 1922 essay on Irish sculpture by the sculptor Oliver Shepherd. Can you tell me, I love these gems that, you know, sometimes it's even more exciting when they're unpublished, I think, Jack. I don't know if you agree.
Yeah,
tell me
absolutely.
A little bit about the context in which you discover this essay and why you specifically decide to publish it in the confines of this book.
Yeah, well, I should say it's an essay that's been documented, if not fully transcribed or published, by John Turpin, who's written, I think, the authoritative biography of Oliver Shepherd. But I was really grateful to the National College of Art and Design in Dublin for allowing me to publish the full essay, because I think it sort of speaks to some of those overlapping thoughts on public monuments in Ireland and the politics of them that Yeats is interested in at this time. Shepherd is a sculptor who, as I said, Yeats went to school with in the Metropolitan School of Art and the Royal Hibernian Academy in the 1880s. And he's a figure that then Yeats overlaps with in various ways, often responding to sculptures by Shepherd in later years, but also persuading Oliver Shepherd to come back from France to take up position in the Metropolitan School of Art in Dublin in, I think, the 1910s. And this is an essay in which Shepherd is quite critical of the standard of public monuments or statues in Ireland and pushes for more mythic representations of Ireland's past through its statues. He doesn't have much time for the monument to Parnell, for example, on O'Connell Street, but he's also keen that perhaps an Irish version of Apollo, maybe a Cathulain or Oisin and Niamh, both are works by himself, maybe these would be subjects appropriate for public statuary. And particularly for Ireland, I think this is slightly ahead of its time, and that this interest in, or that statue mania, as it's sometimes called, this interest in elevating public figures through sculpture, particularly in a newly independent Ireland, is one about hero worship and perhaps developing a sort of new history through marble and bronze and immortalizing those Irish statesmen to replace the old statues to Queen Victoria or to various monarchs that we see in the city. And in some ways, I think this chimes with Yeats's own unease at times with these public monuments, though Yeats, of course, was still keen to preserve the monuments once they're erected in public squares or parks. But it also shows, I think, that correlative interest in the Celtic revival being a renaissance not just of poetry and of literature, but also the proliferation of Celtic revival statues in public squares, and seeing that revival as something that takes place across art forms. It's not just confined to literature, but to the visual arts more broadly.
In a book like this, Jack, I suppose one of the things that's inspiring you or motivating you is what you're bringing that's new to the table. I note that that W.B. Yeats and the Language of Sculpture is the first comprehensive study of Yeats and the visual arts in over three decades. You're not the first person to write on this aspect as such, but when you think about what you're contributing to the historiography on him in this vein, Jack, where do you kind of position yourself kind of generally?
Yeah, that's a great question. There is some excellent scholarship on Yeats and the visual arts. Elizabeth Bergman Loazu's book, Yeats and the Visual Arts, Charles Armstrong and Tom Walker more recently have been publishing on Yeats and art writing as well. I hope that my book sort of is a contribution that thinks about the specificity of sculpture and perhaps elevates that idea of medium specificity, that sculpture might be taken as a special category and not always treated within an umbrella term of visual culture or the arts. And I think, at least for my book, that enabled me to talk in more detail about statues and statuary, but also about Yeats's proximity to these sculptors through art school and then in various modernist magazines responding to the works of abstract artists as well. So I sort of hope that, as valuable as it is to sort of continue thinking about Yeats across art forms, that this appreciation of one specific art form can also delve to sort of new depths and more layers of Yeats's life and his writing as well.
And is that, Jack, because of the kind of public-facing opportunity inherent in sculpture in terms of public monuments as opposed to maybe other aspects of visual arts, which would be, I mean, probably heavy-handed state in this way, but kind of more elitist in terms of, like, who's engaging with them? Is that generally how, is that, would I be right in assuming that that might be kind of why you lean into arguing or presenting that perhaps sculpture should be kind of not just lumped into the visual arts?
Yeah, I think that's certainly part of it. I think there's a new urgency to public monuments and statues as well in both the UK and the US and Ireland, and sort of reflection on the appropriateness of certain monuments, the debates around hostile statuary that might be Confederate or slave owners, and I think the importance of making more equitable public spaces and taking down these outdated statues is something that's made a lot of people more aware of the urgency of these debates. And I think public monuments stand out for that reason, or public art certainly does, as something that people encounter in their daily lives. And I don't necessarily think Yeats is a hero for that cause. I think sometimes he can be quite conservative in his tastes and also wants to preserve equestrian sculptures of British monarchs in an independent Ireland. But I think those issues are ones that we find writers responding to more often, or perhaps in more creative ways than the high art reserved for galleries or for independent collectors.
Jack, the book is out, I suppose it's a little under 2 months or so, so it might be a little bit early to ask you this question, but in the engagement that you've had to date around the topic and around your book, How have scholars and a general reader engaged with this topic of discussion and analysis in terms of Yeats and his contributions?
I haven't actually received any reviews yet, for better or worse, I suppose. It's only the end of June that it came out, and in fact, I don't think it's out in the US until the 30th of August. But as I sort of mentioned in the acknowledgements, I got a lot of support through the writing of it, and both my sort of supervisors and mentors at postdoctoral stage were vital in reviewing it and giving assistance throughout the writing of it, and were so constructive in their feedback that I sort of felt that there was a book to be made out of it.
Mm-hmm. I had the pleasure, Jack, of meeting you in the context of a recent Fulbright stint, which you undertook in New York. Can you tell us a little bit about what outside of presumably tasting good New York pizza or, you know, going to Central Park and kind of the very fun things, did you have some time and what did you get up to in terms of some of your intellectual pursuits while you were in New York?
I had a wonderful time. I was in New York for 3 months as you mentioned, sort of as a Fulbright scholar through Fulbright Ireland. Was affiliated with the Glucksman Ireland House at NYU. I spent most of my time in the New York Public Library researching in the Berg Collection and also in the Art and Architecture Special Collections at the Public Library. And this was for a project thinking not about sculpture for a change, it was about illustration and Celtic Revival writers and their illustrators. So it's quite early days at the minute, but what I was really looking at was various Irish writers of the early 20th century and their collaboration or connection with quite avant-garde or modernist illustrators. So Padraig Colum, Ella Young, some of the versions of Yeats's books as well, have obviously very different covers and sometimes inside illustrations to the US or the international publications as they do in Ireland. And I was particularly interested in Colum and Young and their connection to illustrators like Boris Artsebashev, the Russian emigre artist who lived in New York, Willie Pogany, and several others who have quite abstract illustrative styles and ones that you wouldn't necessarily see in 1910s or 1920s Ireland being commissioned for these books. So I spent quite a bit of time in the public library looking at that. I was also quite lucky that when I got over in the spring of this year, there was an exhibition of the modernist illustrator Edward McKnight Kaufer in the Cooper Hewitt Museum up on the Upper East Side. So I felt like I was able to overlap the donkey work of archival research with seeing real exhibitions of some of these modernist illustrators that I've been so interested in. And I think New York was the ideal city to sort of overlap both the practicalities of research with the fun of walking through these galleries and museums and some of the best galleries and museums in the world and seeing those artworks on display.
New York, in a way, and I'm sure, Jack, when you were there, there are connections of the Yeats family, of course, to New York City. Did you perchance come across any of those in particular at NYPL while you were there, or tell us a little bit about those connections of the Yeats family to New York City?
On this occasion, I wasn't looking at the Yeats family as much. Had this nice period of almost weaning myself off the Yeatses for this new project, but I have in the past visited the Berg collection specifically to look at that Yeats material, and there's a great wealth of that, as well as Lady Gregory, who features quite heavily in my book and in my research, as well as George Russell and Padraig Colum. John Yeats lived for quite a few years, for the end of his life, in New York, often supported by the art collector John Quinn, who's no relation to me, I should mention. So I've spent quite a bit of time looking at those collections, as well as the John Quinn papers that are in the public library as well. And W.B. Yeats often visited his father in New York City during this time in which John Yeats was mainly being paid to produce an enormous, ultimately unfinished self-portrait of himself. And many times Yeats's familiarity with modern art overlaps with these visits to New York, but also his correspondence with John Quinn, who was such a keen collector of Constantin Brancusi and of those vorticist artists I mentioned in the book.
Wow, those connections are fascinating, Jack. We've come across some of them in the context of some of the work at NYU that we did around Quinn, actually. And just it never ceases to amaze me how networked all these individuals were in a transatlantic and local New York context in this era. You know, I think sometimes we think that the internet, you know, it invented all those kind of ways of people connecting, but it's clear they were there long before anything like that. And it's really fascinating to hear your work touch on them as well. Jack, it's been wonderful to have this opportunity to chat with you, and for me to have an opportunity to learn more about Yeats, a lot more than I knew about his engagement with the visual arts and with sculpture in particular. And I think, having spoken to you, and I'm looking forward to reading your book cover to cover, of course, I feel like I won't engage with Yeats's writing in quite such a blasé way as much on the basis of how you've kind of opened up our eyes a little bit. And I commend you. That's such a wonderful thing for any piece of research or any book to do. And I'm really delighted that you've taken the time out to speak to me today on this Irish American life, and for us to have the opportunity to share with our listeners the fruits of your fascinating research as you mentioned, the book is available in the United States at the end of August. Did you say the 30th of August, Jeff?
That's right. I think so. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure that listeners will be interested in picking up a copy and sharing with others the fruits of your labour. Enjoy this little, I guess, rest period as you ramp up. By the sounds of things, you've something in mind, Jack, and it'll only take a short period of time for you to get your teeth stuck in. But it's nice to have a little bit of a break, isn't it, after you've finished one big project?
It is, yeah. Thank you so much, Miriam. It's been great to chat to you.
Thanks for coming on today, Jack. We look forward to future interventions and future publications. Hopefully you'll be back on with us again on This Irish American Life.
Following on from that wonderful interview with Jack, I just wanted to look at some of the poetry which had been referenced by him. This gives me an opportunity to refamiliarise myself with some of the WBH poetry that we all grew up and we've all appreciated down through the years and decades. I was particularly interested on foot of the conversation with Jack to think about his poems on sculpture. And there are three short ones that touch on that topic. The first is To Be Carved on a Stone at Thor Ballylee by W. B. Yeats. I, the poet, William Yeats, with old mill boards and sea-green slates and smithy work from the Gort Forge, restored this tower for my wife, George, and may these characters remain when all is ruin once again. The Three Monuments, also by W. B. Yeats. They hold their public meetings where our most renowned patriots stand. One among the birds of the air, a stumpier on either hand, and all the popular statesmen say that purity built up the state, and after kept it from decay, and let all base ambition be, for intellect would make us proud, and pride bring in impurity. The three old rascals laugh aloud. And this third short one, The Living Beauty by W. B. Yeats. I'll say, and maybe dream I have drawn content, seeing that time has frozen up the blood, the wick of youth being burned and the oil spent, from beauty that is cast out of a mould in bronze, or that in dazzling marble appears but when we have gone is gone again, being more indifferent to our solitude than 'twere an apparition. O heart, we are old. The living beauty is for younger men. We cannot pay its tribute of wild tears. You can see the references to sculpture very much in those three short ones. And indeed, another one called The Statues from his last collection, Last Poems, is another one which is very interesting to consider in this context as well. Or Lapsus Lazuli by William Butler Yeats. I have heard that hysterical women say they are sick of the palette and fiddle bow of poets that are always gay, for everybody knows or else should know that if nothing drastic is done, aeroplane and zeppelin will come out, pitch like King Billy bomb balls in until the town lie beaten flat. All perform their tragic play, there struts Hamlet, there is Lear, that's Ophelia, that Cordelia. Yet they, should the last scene be there, the great stage curtain about to drop, if worthy their prominent part in the play, do not break up their lines to weep. They know that Hamlet and Lear are gay, gaiety transfiguring all that dread. All men have aimed at, found and lost, black out. Heaven blazing into the head, tragedy wrought to its uttermost. Though Hamlet rambles and Lear rages, and all the drop scenes drop at once upon 100,000 stages, it cannot grow by an inch or an ounce. On their own feet they came, or on shipboard, camelback, horseback, assback, muleback, old civilizations put to the sword. Then they and their wisdom went to rack, no handiwork of Camulcus, who handled marble as if were bronze, made draperies that seemed to rise when sea wind swept the corner, stands his long lamp, chimney-shaped like the stem of a slender palm, stood but a day. All things fall and are built again, and those that build them again are gay. Two Chinamen lie behind them, a third are carved in lapis lazuli. Over them flies a long-legged bird, a symbol of longevity. The third, doubtless a serving man, carries a musical instrument. Every discoloration of the stone, every accidental crack or dent, seems like a watercourse or an avalanche, or lofty slope where it still snows, though doubtless plum or cherry branch sweetens the little halfway house. Those Chinamen climb towards, and I delight to imagine them seated there, there on the mountain and the sky, on all the tragic scene they stare. One asks for mournful melodies, accomplished figures begin to play, their eyes mid many wrinkles, their eyes, their ancient glittering eyes are gay. Wonderful poetry and fantastic references there to sculpture once again. Very grateful for this opportunity on this week's This Irish American Life through the great research of Jack Quinn and his new book to explore this wonderful aspect of the poetry of W.B. Yeats. I hope you enjoyed that little reading. It's a while since I've read some poetry and it was a nice treat. This broadcast of WNYE's Irish Radio Hour, This Irish American Life, comes to you in association with Flannelly Promotions Limited. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan Gray, and I am your host every Saturday morning on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, and broadcasting worldwide on www.irishradio.com. Our theme music is The Opening Set by The Gloaming, released by Brassland and Real World Records.